Ricardo Romero, welcome to COVID Race and Democracy. I know it wasn't easy for you to do this interview today, so I appreciate you taking the time and making the effort. Can you please introduce yourself and briefly tell our listeners a couple of things you think are most important to know about you?
My name is Ricardo Romero. I was born in Brighton, Colorado, and I've spent all my life in Colorado. And probably the most significant thing I'd like people to know about me is I've been a community organizer since the last 51 years and tried to contribute whatever I could to the betterment of humanity. And also, I was one of the co-founders of the Crusade for Justice in 1966. I was also one of the founders of the Mexican National Liberation Movement in 1979, and I'm still a member at the present time. So I think those are the two highlights of my life, my involvement in the Chicano-Mexicano movement, Chicano-Mexicano community, and continuing all these years trying to affect some change for the betterment of humanity.
And how would you like us to identify you organizationally now?
Just the Mexican National Liberation Movement, and I would say as Chicano-Mexicanos.
Okay, let me ask you about that term, the significance for you of why you choose to identify yourself as Chicano-Mexicano.
Well, what it means to me is that we are really a Mexican people living in occupied Mexico, with a militarily imposed border. And I think most people don't realize that the seven states, Colorado, Nuevo Mexico, Texas, Arizona, California, Nevada, and Utah, were all part of the Mexican nation. And when you study any type of history in terms of the Mexican-American War, they always say the United States annexed. They did not annex this land. They conquered it. They declared war on us in 1846, terminating in 1848 with the signing of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. And I think it's important to understand the whole question of a militarily imposed border, because then we have to address the question of settler colonialism for the Chicano-Mexicanos in the United States. And I think it's essential that that is done, that that surfaces, that comes out politically. That's what our struggle's about. And a lot of people, even in the southern part of the nation, in Mexico right now, don't understand the term Chicano. And to me, it's like if you're from Mexico City, they call themselves the Chilangos. If you're from Monterrey, they call them Locodos de Monterrey. If you're from Veracruz, they're the Jarochos from Veracruz. Well, we're the Chicanos from north of the military imposed border, but that doesn't mean that we're not Mexicanos. It's just a su nombre that is used. And I think it's important for us to start to recognize that, to create this national unity within our nation.
And let's go deeper into that, because one of the issues that's, you know, the hottest debate in the news and politics is the issue of migration and immigration across this U.S.-Mexico border that, as you point out, has been militarily imposed. But, you know, in the mainstream debate, it's framed in ways that just accept the legitimacy of the border and the right of the U.S. to prevent Mexicans and others from entering this country. But you mentioned several organizations that have challenged that narrative that you've been a part of. You were a leader in the Crusade for Justice, which hosted the Chicano Youth Liberation Conference in 1969. And I believe that's where the concept of Aztlan was first popularized. And then in the 70s, and since, you've been a leader in the Movimiento de Liberación Nacional, which fought for the socialist reunification of Mexico. So I wanted to just really go into that. Like, what can we learn from the Chicano-Mexicano movements that you've been a part of about this issue of migration, immigration, and the border?
Well, beginning in middle 60s and 65, 66, 67, there was a whole coming together of the beginning aspects of the Chicano movement. And I think what's really important was that for the first time, we were starting to address the question of national identity and who we were. And we were not recognized by the United States government, and we did not feel that the United States government ever lived up to any of their treaty rights with us, but that wasn't surprising because they never lived up to any treaty they ever signed with the indigenous people. And so we're part of that whole era, and we're also an indigenous people to the Americas. And I think in 1968-69, the first Chicano Youth Liberation Conference, when the question of Aztlan was raised, it was a call for nationhood, an indigenous nation in the Americas. And the reason I think it's essential that we make a call for an indigenous nation in the Americas for ourselves, the Mexica people, the Mexicanos, was that a lot of people think that we're Spanish, that we were affected by Spanish colonialism. And there was a creation of a division there where they said we became mestizos and half European and half indigenous people. And if we really understand our true history, and I think that's why Aztlan was so important, that the concept of Aztlan came out. A lot of the left in the United States ridiculed it and said it was a spiritual concept. It was all of these things. And the Communist Party in the United States would set forth that that was a primitive communism with the indigenous nations that existed in all that time period, which we totally disagree with. There's no such thing as primitive communism. It was sharing and working together and building the nations, the seven cultures of the Americas. And it's a whole history that would probably take more than the time we have to discuss, but it was so important. Because for the first time, we were raising the question of nationhood. Tijerina did it in 1966, 65. He started doing the work around the Spanish land grants. There was a division at the Chicano Youth Conference over the question of the Spanish land grants or whether indigenous nations. And I agree with the whole concept that we were an indigenous people to the Americas. And therefore, we do not immigrate from Mexico across the border into the United States. We migrate. We come from the Americas. The immigrants were the Europeans and other people who had to cross oceans and immigrated to come here. And we're not immigrants. And I think we have to really start questioning that, because that's the concept that the Europeans have about us, that we're immigrants. How can we be immigrants? Our nation is divided and half is in the north, half is in the south. And we just migrate from one part of the south to the north or from the north to the south. And Central Americans are the same way. They come and they migrate from Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, or whatever, or the Latin Americans that come. They don't immigrate, they migrate also.
Thank you for that. And I don't want to assume that our listeners necessarily are familiar with some of this history. So if you can just say a little more about what the concept of Aztlan actually was.
Well, I think the concept of Aztlan was created out of the Poets and Artists Workshop. And Alberto Alurista raised the whole question of Aztlan, and he's the one that brought it forth. And so the discussions that went on in the workshop then were around that we were an indigenous people. This was a bronze continent, and we were a people who worked the land, who had a history, who had all these attributes of nationhood. And I think that's the key to what Aztlan did for us. It was a very beginning. And there's different theories of where Aztlan existed. One is that Aztlan was in the southwest, and from the southwest, the Mexicas and other indigenous nations migrated into what is now Mexico City, which was Anahuac. And the concept that where the Mexica people visualized an eagle devouring a serpent was where they were to establish the center of the nation. And that's where you have the eagle devouring the serpent on the Mexican flag. And it's in Anahuac, it's in Mexico City, and that area is there. And so it was a very long migration. And I think for the first time for us, the question of nationhood was raised for us. Chicano Mexicanos in the United States had no concept of nationhood at that time. Like I said, we were not accepted by the United States, and we were not accepted by Mexico at that time period. So that's why I think it was so key and so important. You know, I would have liked to have seen coming out of the youth conference, but it was very early on in the movement that we present a position that we were affected by settler colonialism and that the United States was a settler colonialist state, and that being affected by settler colonialism, we had every right to then fight and struggle to reclaim our homeland.
And I want to get to that actually in a minute. We'll talk about when you transition into the MLN. But before we do that, I just want to ask a little bit more about the crusade, again, for people who may not be familiar, that you were a leader in the Crusade for Justice, which was based in Denver, and you were the head of the school. You had various programs in the community. You were very much under surveillance, and COINTELPRO was targeting the organization. So just say a little bit about what was going on in the community that you were helping to lead at that time.
Well, we were dealing with the whole question of education, police brutality, unemployment, you know, all of the issues that were burning fire in that time period. We were affected by all of that. So when we started the crusade, we had a liberation school that we used to do, and that was headed by Juanita Dominguez. And Teresa Romero said, well, look, why don't we just start a school? Why are we just doing a liberation school for 1 week in the summer? And why don't we just start our own school? She said, and if we put our own children in there, then that's going to give the community a lot of confidence that we think that our school is really going to be successful. So that's how we started. And we started Escuela Tlatelolco, and we had some attributes that were totally different than the public schools at that time. We put forth that we wouldn't go by grades. We would go by the seven cultures of the Americas. So the first grade would be the Olmecas, the second grade would be the Mayas, the third grade would be the Teotihuacanos, the fourth grade would be the Toltecas, the fifth grade would be the Chichimecas, and the sixth grade would be the Zapoteca Mixteca, and the seventh grade would be the Nahualtlacas. And our theory was that if you started in the kindergarten and first grade, and you would go through the sixth grade, you would come out of that school understanding and knowing the seven cultures of the Americas, as everyone would be taught in that grade level that I was mentioning. I had never, ever heard of any of this pre-Columbian history, but in late 68, early 69, four brothers from Mexico came and they taught us Mexican history. And that's the first time we ever learned about, we studied, that I studied anyway, and most of the people that went studied the pre-Columbian history with these professors that came from Mexico. And so to us, it was really an enlightening experience. So we didn't ask for accreditation. We didn't apply for accreditation because, you know, once you start dealing with anything with accreditation and government regulations, you cannot do what you have to do. You cannot teach critical thinking. You cannot teach a real liberating education. So that's why we did it that way. We understood that completely, that we had to be totally different in how we did the school. And I think the first year that we started, it may have been 1969, and we had about 220 students registered, and it was an incredible amount of work. But we had a grassroots community input of teachers, and 90% of them didn't have any degrees. And they did an incredible job. And we could go back today and see the results of a lot that came out of the school at that time period. I left the Crusade in 1974, but the school was, to me, the main thing we ever did. It was the most essential thing we ever did, and it really came out and proved to be successful. And it was so needed. You know, a lot of us didn't have confidence that the community would say they would send their kids, but they did, and they came, and it was an experience that created the West Hyde blowouts and did a lot of incredible things. And so we look back at that in a very positive sense. Then after I left, they got accreditation, and they weren't the same school. It wasn't the same school. It wasn't the same concept.
You know, I would love to have that conversation at another time in more detail. There's so many lessons to learn from that kind of education. But you said you left the Crusade in 1974, and then you went on to help found the Movimiento de Liberación Nacional Mexicano, the Mexican National Liberation Movement. And at that point, the organization first put out the concept of the socialist reunification of Mexico. So can you talk a little bit about what that strategy is and why that was the next step?
Well, I think we came together in 1973. We went to Mexico City, myself and two other comrades. And while we were in Mexico City, we ran into Mario Cantu, who was from San Antonio, Texas. And he was really elated to see us and said, I got a guerrilla group here in Mexico that has taken over land outside of Mexico City in Cuernavaca. And he says, I'm going up to meet with him. It's incredible that I ran into you so you could come with us. And it was me and Corky, and I won't name the third person because I don't know if they would want to be named. We were to go the next day, and then Corky had other commitments and couldn't make it. So me and the other person went. We went to Cuernavaca, and we went to Villa de las Flores, was where there was a land occupation by peasants, and the land of Villa de las Flores belonged to the governor of Morelos, the son of the governor. And so we got to meet Florencio Güero Medrano, and we sat down, we had little discussions, and the discussions lasted for about 4 or 5 hours, and it was just an amazing experience for us to get there. And they had already built about 400 homes out of tin, cardboard, whatever they could get their hands on. And they were working on a clinic, and they had their street names and their Avenida Ho Chi Minh and Centro Che Guevara. And it was just a mind-blowing experience for us. And in our discussions, Güero Medrano raised the question. He said, well, you know, Mexico's no different than Vietnam. And I said, well, how so? And he says, well, it has a north and a south to it. In Vietnam, the north is liberated and the south is the occupied territories. And he said, in Mexico, and the south is a dependent capitalist state and the north is occupied. And that just kind of blew us away, because we had never, ever had that concept of the border and the military and strategically what it meant for the United States. And so that was from that point on that we started making some analysis of the whole question of the border and how the border was an imposed, militarily imposed border. And, you know, how were we to deal with that question? And in 1978, late 78, we formed the Mexican National Liberation Movement. based on the whole concept that the northern half of Mexico was occupied by the United States and the southern half was a dependent capitalist state. So we started to try and work on that and what positions were we going to take on the border. And the MLN's position was always, que se vengan a la brava, just come and cross the border. Why do you need papers to come back into your own land? So that was the position that came out in 69. And we continued to see how it was that we could try and create this movement around a socialist reunification of Mexico. And in that time period, socialism was a lot different than it is today. But that was the original concept. That's where we started from. And also, we continued on as the MLN. We took on a struggle with developers from Arizona and northern New Mexico. Some of our people that were doing work there, a couple of cadres called us and said they were thinking of taking over this land that the Flores family had occupied for 20-some years. And they wanted us to go and talk to them and talk to the Flores family. And so we went down and we talked with them. And I told them, look, we will support however we can, by whatever means necessary, we will support the land occupation. But there's a difference. The land occupation, if anything is won, then it has to belong to the people. And the people are the ones that have to be able to make the decisions of what is done with that land, or else the Mexican National Liberation Movement won't participate in it. Amado Flores agreed, his father agreed, a lot of the elders agreed. And so we came in and we started to develop a strategy nationwide and how to best approach this. And we got a Westward newspaper out of Denver that came and did the first major article on the land occupation. And then from there, the San Francisco Chronicle picked it up and it went national. So we were able to do all of this. And it was the MLN's work that made that happen. After Amado's put in jail and they really harassed his family, harassed him, put him in jail because he burned the court orders to vacate the land. And we just said, well, we're going to continue this occupation. And the occupation continued after Flores was in jail in Santa Fe. And he went to jail, I think he was there maybe a month and a half, 2 months. And then he said he didn't want anything to do with the land question. And so they offered a settlement. And we were pretty shocked that they offered to give us 216 acres of the land with title to it, and we agreed. That happened in 88. The agreement was signed in 1989, and in 1989, we had the first Tierra Maria Youth Brigades, and we started the school at Tierra Maria. From the experience of Tlatelolco, we're always going to continue to somehow build a school. And that's where we did it, and that's how it happened. And the school went on till in 1988, the Attorney General rated us as number one on the New Mexico Crime Commission list over the drug cartels and over the human traffickers, the Mexican MLN, because of our relationship to the Puerto Rican MLN and our relationship to the AIM and our relationship to the Black Liberation Movement. And so we went on and we just started developing a school, and took us 3 years. We built a kitchen, and maybe every year we were up there working and building, and we ended up building a classroom, and the elders had built a cabin, and then a major snowstorm hit and flattened the cabin. And so we then just started to build for classrooms, since we were having the classes in the summer. When the public schools were out, we just built gazebos, and we ended up building 5 gazebos for classrooms. And that time period, in 21 years, we took over 1,100 young people from K California, from Texas, from Chicago, from Denver, from New Mexico. And just 3 years ago, 16 years after we've been doing all these things out of the schools and stuff, the New Mexico Attorney General filed a case on us, and we just ended up losing that land. But we never took advantage. We never endeavored in making any profit or utilizing that land for that. It was always for education. And we feel we did a really great job. And we kind of let our guard down a little, and the state came after us. And so now the state of New Mexico has given that land to a land grant. Some people that are in a land grant out of New Mexico. We raised $24,000 to pay attorneys to take on that case. And that was Jeffrey Haas from the People's Law Office who did the case for us, or else we would never even have been able to do that. We went on to court. They said it was going to cost $50,000. They just bled us out. We couldn't continue. And so we made an agreement that if they would reimburse us for the money we paid for the attorneys and for the money that we paid the taxes for 29 years. Anyway, we made an agreement and they've taken over that land, and I don't know what will happen there, but we utilized it as best we could for as long as we could. And then our supportive base up there were all elderly people, and most of them passed away. Nicolas Lopez and the Aguilar family, Gregorita and her husband and his twin brother, who were part of the courthouse raid that happened there in 1967. And so we knew we were successful in what we were doing because the government eventually came after us again.
That's a really amazing and inspiring story, and more people need to know about it. Part of our purpose in doing this show is really to try to draw out some of the lessons from the Chicano Mexicano movement for organizers and especially for anti-imperialists today. And, you know, we live in this time when, on the one hand, increasing numbers of people do realize that there are some deep systemic problems in the U.S., and there actually was this huge upsurge in activism against white supremacy and police terror, you know, after George Floyd, although some of that energy has dissipated or been co-opted since Biden's election. But the state and the corporate media always try to divide us into the good, peaceful activists who work within the system, and then those bad, militant protesters who deserve to be demonized and repressed. And certainly the organizations and work you've done have always been about the need for systemic change, the right to self-determination, the importance of international solidarity. And because of that, you have always been subjected to repression personally and organizationally, I know. So talk a little about that kind of attempt by the state to divide us into the good and the bad activists who work within the system, and what we can learn from the Chicano Mexicano movement about the importance of international solidarity and really a different kind of movement.
Well, every people have a reactionary element to it. Everyone, whether it be Cubans, Chinese, Mexicans, Puerto Ricans. There was always the 3%, as Fanon wrote, you know, they take 3% of your population, make them a mere reflection of the settler, and then they project them as your leadership. And that's what happens. And so that's always going to be there. And it's a kind of a fine line, because you get involved in struggling against them folks, and then folks really have no power. They're just tools in the pawn game of imperialism, and you get tied up fighting them, and you don't get to continue your organizing and doing what is key for the people. And I think that's a real important lesson that we have to learn. We can't make these kind of things the priority. The priority is always a settler colonialist state. And it's the responsibility of every colonized subject to wage a struggle to free their land. And the living proof of that is the Native Americans in the United States. Nobody ever understands or really raises the question of the Holocaust that has taken place in North and South America with the Native people. And that's because it has to do with land. And anything that has to do with land, that puts you in the crosshairs of imperialism. Because we put forth that Tierra Maria was the first liberated zone in occupied Mexico. And we always put that out. We put that out. We put that out. And so anything that you do that you're effective, if your organization is touching a real fine nerve of the state, they have to react. They have to. Their whole effort is total control. In the 50 years I've been involved, we started out with the whole question of civil rights because we didn't understand that it was a question of human rights. Eventually, we got there. But when you get to these higher levels, then they have an apparatus that they created in the late 1950s and 60s, the counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO. And then some congressmen found out Hoover had this program. They told him he couldn't be doing that. So he just changed the name and put it under another filing and kept it going. And when we look back now at the Chicano-Americano movement, in 1972, they assassinate Ricardo Falcón on his way to the National La Las Unidas Conference. In 1973, they attacked the Crusade for Justice. The dormitories of the school where some of our teachers lived. They killed Luis Martinez, and there was a shootout with the police, and they blew up the building that Mario Vasquez was in, and they beat a lot of people that night, terrorized a lot of people. And then in 1974, they killed the Boulder Six. Supposedly, the state said they were trying to assemble bombs out in Chautauqua Park at one spot where there's no lights, no whatsoever, and the other car was at Pudlock's liquor store. In 1978, maybe, Carlos Zapata was killed in a bomb explosion. So we realized late in the game that this was all part of the COINTEL program. The attack was a brutal attack. And the leadership of the Chicano movement at that time period didn't address it correctly because they believed in bourgeoisie democracy and reform. That's what they were all embedded in. And we look back, we make all these analyses now, and we see exactly what happened to us. We were able to work on putting on the film, The Symbols of Resistance of the Chicano-Americano Movement. It's important that people understand this. That's just Colorado. New Mexico, I don't know. They probably have as many martyrs or maybe even more than us. California has Ruben Salazar and Angel Diaz and Lynn Ward from the first moratorium and the second moratorium. Montague, who was a Sephardic Jew and supported the Brown Berets and the Chicano movement, and he was killed. And the farm workers had like 7 or 8 people that were killed. So, you know, we've never been able to do a national push to identify the martyrs of the Chicano-Americano struggle, but there are many, many. And COINTELPRO uses the same strategy against everybody else, not just one group. They've used it against everybody. The Native Americans, they decimated AIM on the reservations and killed over 300 of their top organizers and base people. That's how the left usually finds things out 20 years later, 30 years later, you know. When we see these kind of things that have happened, what we were trying to do politically was successful because they had to move against us, and they did. And people say, well, there's no documentation. And why do you need documentation? We have 9 martyrs from Colorado and the other martyrs from all the other states. That's the living proof of what happened to our movements. And we never had a leadership that created a secondary leadership that would continue the movements after they were gone. They were pretty egocentric people. And they never did that. So now our people are in search of something again. and it'll surface once more. I don't know. I may not be here. But if I am, I'm definitely going to be a part of whatever I can do.
And in the face of all of that repression, the grand jury was used as a political tool, and you refused to participate, and you and others were imprisoned for resisting the grand jury. But in the face of all of that repression, the price that you and others had to pay and your share of disappointments and setbacks, you've still stuck to your principles all these years. You continue to organize and inspire in your community. And I wonder what sustained you through all of that and what's giving you hope after 50 years of facing this level of repression?
Well, I think for me and for a lot of people, Ho Chi Minh, Chairman Mao, Che Guevara, those are the inspirations, and that's the character of the movement that we wanted to be a part of, to do for the people, to do for our communities, to do for all people, to become internationalists, to go to prison supporting the Puerto Rican independence movement. We did it. Maria Cueto and Pedro Archuleta and myself. And it comes out of what it is that you internally believe that it's going to take to change the system. And it's not just us, and it's not just here, but it's the whole worldwide misery that people suffer and live because of this empire. So that's what's maintained me. Always. And I've never gave up, I'll never cave in, and I'll never quit. And I think I'm going to be able to own up to that because I'm 86 and I'm heading the other way. But we have left some young people, and there's going to be more young people, and they'll have to decide based on their own social reality and their own social conditions what character they want to take in terms of being part of the struggle, you know. And I think when I see and get to talk to young people, it just elates me, and it just takes me to another level, because that's the future and they're there. And it's not really how we have to reach them, it's how they have to internalize their own reality and see what it is they want to do. And there'll be more. And I think that's the future I look forward to.
That's beautiful. Is there anything else that you think is important to say to the listeners that I haven't asked you about?
Yeah, I believe that all the adults, the older adults that came out or were part of these movements, we have a responsibility to support our youth. However we can, wherever we can, we have to do that. And they're going to need that, and they're going to need their communities behind them, and they're going to need their communities to open doors for them and help them to develop a movement for social change and revolution that is valid and has validity in the future. I'd like to say another person that I think we should really emulate is David Gilbert.
Mm-hmm.
David's a wonderful, beautiful, incredible human being, and he deserves to be acknowledged, just like Mumia Abu-Jamal and all the political prisoners that are still there and doing time and that have upheld them principles, you know.
Absolutely. And if there are people who want to get more involved or get more information, are there any sources that you might suggest?
We have a new director at our center here in Greeley, and it's Monica Salazar. And the P.O. Box for Al Frente de Lucha is P.O. Box 200021, Evans, Colorado, 80620. And then also online, you can go to Al Frente de Lucha and see what it is we're planning, what we're doing, what activities we're trying to maintain. And Monica Salazar is the contact.
Okay, great. Well, Ricardo Romero, I hope all of our listeners have been as inspired by your insights and your commitment to the struggle over these 50 years as I have been. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Ken. It's always good to talk to good comrades and good people.